Hi there, and welcome back to another edition of Built to Sell Radio, the podcast designed to help you punch above your weight in a negotiation to sell your company. I'm the executive producer, Colin Morgan, and today on the show, you're going to hear from Jordan Van Schindel, who grew his service business to more than 30 employees without having anyone quit. Now, he credits his unique culture for the loyalty of his team. Ultimately, it was that team that caught the attention of Spiria, who offered to acquire his business for a double-digit multiple. Here to share with you the full story is Jordan Van Schindel. Enjoy.
Jordan Van Schindel, welcome to Built to Sell Radio.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
How did you start a business with the curious name Dev Barbecue? Give me the story here.
Yeah, well, you know, names are so important in businesses. I've learned kind of the hard way multiple times. But and when we talk about the sale of Dev Barbecue, we'll talk a little bit about that again. But no, it was, 2011 or so. I was 25 years old. I'd spent 3 years in the workforce out of a software engineering degree. Those 3 years were really my only years of having a real job, learning on somebody else's dime. And then I joined up with two other software developers, who we all worked at the same company together. So you can imagine, three software guys, put me in a corner, let me code, don't talk to me. That's who we were. We started a company. We got kind of the Kevin Costner philosophy of if you build something great and cool, they will come. But again, no business experience, super naive. We were at this just this barbecue restaurant and said, look, let's leave this place and let's start this product. We had a great idea. It doesn't matter what the product was. We thought was a great idea. And we started the business initially as a product company, but it was accidentally turned into a digital transformation services business, taking contracts for software development jobs like data engines, mobile apps, the real high tech stuff, APIs, bank integrations, all that kind of stuff. That was our
background. You guys became a custom development shop where if someone wanted a mobile app, they would hire you and you'd create the mobile.
That's right.
Or
exactly
a website or a digital product of some sort. Got it. And I think a lot of our listeners would identify with that business model. They're in a service business. Many of them are in service businesses. So while they may not know software development, there's a lot of parallels between other custom development type of companies where there's a client that needs to, a project solved or a problem solved, and you go out doing it. What was the business model? How did you guys bill? Was it like hourly or how did you make money?
Yeah, as you said, John, it's common. The business model is common across that services industry for sure. We had time and materials for a while. We had monthly retainers. We had project based. Those were the main sources of revenue. Over the years, we found time and materials really hurt. It didn't really foster the right relationship and the right incentives between us and our customers. So we really tried to move the needle on our customer experience by just doing those monthly retainers. So here's a team, here's a pod or a team, whatever you want to call it, of development and product management and design and everything. Here's everything that services your problem, and pay us each month. We commit to some deliverables every month. There was kind of a hybrid there between deliverables and time. But again, we weren't accounting for hours. We weren't time. We actually a services business. We were not time tracking ourselves. And we weren't reporting back and nitpicking over hours and dollars and cents here and there with our customers. So I think that's where we ended up by the end, and it worked out.
It's kind of like a legal retainer where you agreed up front, hey, this is all the stuff we're going to do each month for you, and let's just agree that we're going to bill you the same amount every month.
That's right. Yeah. And there were months where we would exceed that. There were months where we'd fall a bit short, but we always kept the lines of communication open. That was key. I mean, we're in business. Business is humans, right? As much as we wanted to deal with computers as software developers, we learned very quickly that's not how the world works. So we found that.
How'd you guys divvy up the equity? Did you just go a third, a third, a third, or what was that like?
That's a very good question, John. We did a third, a third, a third. I eventually bought out my partners after a couple of years, both of them amicably. It was really important to all of us that it all become amicably. At the start of the partnership, at most partnerships, you know, everything's roses and flowers and everything like that. But over time, things change. Life circumstances change. People need liquidity for whatever reason, or their skill sets prove to not be exactly what the company needs after a pivot or something like that. So yeah, that's what happened. I became.
What happened in your case?
What happened? Yeah. Well, both. Like, first of all, I think one of my partners, great dude, love him to death. He was supposed to be sort of the business developer and the sales guy. He had the most business experience and most contracting experience out of the three of us. So, and my other partner, Kevin, and I, we were the stronger engineers. So Jeremy brought in a bunch of contracts at the onset. And while we were trying to build our product, and funding it through services, we tried to do that, but doing that and paying ourselves, like, we just had to eat. And Jeremy kind of exhausted his network and didn't know where to go from there. So he was the first to kind of say, he raised his own hand and he said, look, guys, like, I'm not sure that I'm the right fit going forward. If you guys really want to take this into the engineering space, you know, buy me out. So cool. That was.
How'd you figure out the formula to buy him out? What was the formula around which you bought him out?
Oh, let me think about that. We didn't have much to go on at the time. We had a bit of revenue. We had the contracts that he had brought in. If I remember correctly, it was sort of a third of a 1x revenue. So yeah, I guess we valued the company at around 1x revenue, but we discounted a little bit because of his circumstances and the skill sets just not really aligning to where the company needed to go. Plus, we were at that point we were really cash strapped. And we did a bit of a deal over time as well, if I remember correctly, on a payout.
So you just paid him out over time as opposed to one lump sum.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense. And then what about your fellow developer? What made you kind of part ways with him?
Yeah, Kevin, we didn't part ways. Actually, he still works with Spiria, the company that acquired Dev Barbecue. And he became, or he remained like a very loyal, hardworking employee of the company. But I think that's what he wanted was employment. You know, the risk of entrepreneurship, the long hours, all the sacrifices that one makes when you are an entrepreneur. He was in a stage of life where you know, he just couldn't afford to take those risks. More on kind of like the personal interest side. And anyway, I won't speak completely for him, but it was very amicable. He had a wedding coming up as well. So we just said, look, Kevin, here's kind of the same formula as Jeremy. Here's where the business is at today. Let's build a way for the business to give you some liquidity and you can exit, but stay on, right, and help me build this as your friend and ex-partner. And he did. And it was fantastic.
What was it like to go from three musketeers, all for one for all, you know, a shared leadership, to all of a sudden finding yourself the sole owner and CEO of Dev Barbecue? What emotions would you use to describe that?
I remember coming out of the lawyer's office with Kevin on that day, and we drove there together to sign the papers. And he asked me how I was feeling. And I said, I am very scared. I was scared. I had to muster up the confidence to get into the car and go home and tell the employees, you know, what was going on. I had just accepted responsibility in my mind for all of their families. I was starting a family at that point as well. And I suppose I just needed to keep telling myself, you know, that I can do it, that this is a risk. Looking at it pragmatically, I was still young. I could accept that risk. And I was hungry. I knew my goals. I knew what I wanted. That was a common theme throughout my years with Dev Barbecue. I always knew what I wanted. I suppose that I wanted to do one of two things. Step back from the business one day and leave it in somebody else's hands, capable hands. Or sell it off in a way that, would afford me, some specific things in terms of lifestyle. I always wanted a property up north, a cottage in sort of like the Muskoka area. I wanted to be able to travel. I wanted to be able to give my kids, what they need to go to school, to help them buy a car, to help them buy their first home, to put money aside for the estate when we're dead, you know, those kind of things. That's what I wanted out of the business, that security, I suppose.
So this was a, you know, it sounds crass to say it, but a wealth creation engine for you. You wanted to build and sell and create the wealth that would allow you to check all these boxes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that was a major, I'm not going to lie. It's shallow. But that was a big motivator for me for sure. But in a non-shallow way, I wasn't really doing it for me so I could go out and party. I was doing it for my family. And that was sort of a sole focus. For me, my family and the people who helped me, my employees, my mentors, I used the business to their benefit as well.
How big was the company, you know, either, you know, number of full-time employees or revenue when Kevin left? Like roughly where were you at that stage?
When Kevin left,
when Kevin sold his equity, I should say.
Yeah, I'll restate that. When Kevin exited as a partner, I think we were around 7 employees, I would say. And in terms of revenue, it was, you know, maybe 400 or 500K a year. So we were still, we were still pretty small, but it's a difficult stage as most of the listeners would likely know.
Yeah. I call it the fog of war. It's like too small to really have a C-level team of managers to do the work, but also too big to just kind of do it all yourself. You need helpers, and it's that middle ground, which is dangerous territory for a lot of founders, for sure. What did you find to be the, if you kind of flash forward up until your exit, you're at 400 grand in revenue, 7 employees, something like that, up until a successful exit to Spiria, What would you say was the number one most important thing that you did to build the value of your company?
I can say with 100% confidence, it was the culture that we built. In the services business, you know, the people make a huge difference. And, you know, you can state that your processes are better, your operations are better, you deliver better, faster, cheaper. But it all starts with culture.
So what made your culture unique?
The foundational philosophy that I tried to instill was, that, you know, you as an employee supported the business, and in turn, that business supported you, and it worked, and it worked both ways. It was a two-way street. But every day when you came to work, you'd be responsible for your own personal development. You'd be responsible for the development of your peers, but you also held responsibility for the hopes and dreams and families of our clients who trusted us enough to hire us. So coming to work with that purpose every day, fostered a culture where we grew by the end to anywhere between 30 and 50 people, because we had to fluctuate based on our services, our service volume. We had one voluntary departure in the 6 years that this business ran. So, and in the world of development, is unheard of. Engineers, even back then, were moving around to better paying jobs, different projects here and there. But another thing that I attribute it to was having even keeled emotions throughout, those years. So we never celebrated too much, but we never got down too much either. We kept a very level head, when it came to all the business happenings. And I think that lack of volatility around the company created some stability for people. I also hired hired, I think, the right people. We had to obviously let people go, but when we did, it was always sort of for the greater good. And that helped a lot as well, because people would have to come, contractors would come, contractors would go, employees would have to go, on our terms, which is never fun. But, you know, the way it was seen, I think was important as well. And transparency, everyone knew where the company was at any given point. I had this saying, because Game of Thrones was really popular.
What level of information did you choose to share with employees? Like, were you sharing revenue, gross margin, EBITDA? Like, what did you share with them?
I was sharing revenue above all things. I think I shared margin maybe once a year. Didn't really share EBITDA. I mean, the employees didn't care about financials or anything like that. They just wanted to know they just wanted to know, in their perspective, the company was growing in a way where they could grow as well. And that's really, anything that I shared was backed on that.
Got it. It's fascinating, because I think in a services business, culture is so important, yet so nebulous, so hard to sort of put in a bottle, describe, impart on others how you did it. And I want to try, because I think one voluntary departure in, 4X-ing a service business is incredible, especially in software development, where the demands for these employees is really, really high. So let's just try to get more practical for our audience. Let's imagine someone listening, they've got 10 employees. They feel like their culture's okay, but not great. It's not as good as they would hope. Maybe they've got a little employee turnover. Like, what practical things did you guys do that you would do again if given the opportunity? Practically, what sorts of, policies did you have, or philosophies did you impart?
It's a good question. Let me think about that for a second.
Because some people bring the dog to work day, or, you get your birthday off, or, mandatory 3% inflation-based, salary increases every year, and yet their cultures suck. Everybody hates each other, and there's this sense of animosity. Right. And yet some cultures, there are no bonuses, there are no flex time. In fact, people work harder than they would be working in a more traditional job, yet somehow the culture, is able to bubble up and create this like high performance work environment. So how did you guys do it?
Great. Well, thanks. Those are some good examples to jog my memory. The philosophy that you're there to serve the business so that it can serve you, and that you're serving your fellow employees and you're serving our set of clients and their hopes and dreams, that being our underlying philosophy and sort of our, I guess you could call it our purpose, our mission. I know they're different, but that being always reinforced was very helpful, because people were there for the right reasons. If you weren't there for the right reasons, you could tell, and we would axe, we'd throw the axe down, kind of thing. I have always believed in even-keeled emotions. So being able to not celebrate the highs too much and not get low on the lows. So that was a sense of stability. Great projects. I always checked in personally. Even when we were kind of at our largest, it was a lot of work, but I would check in personally, just even, how's it going? Jackie, how's it going? Here are some decisions that I made recently. Here's how they affect you. So just that transparency. And it just fostered a sense of loyalty, I think. And I think, we were on the bleeding edge back then of unlimited vacation. So we had unlimited vacation. We did not constrain people. We realized they had lives. If they needed to take a day here because their kid was sick or anything, it was no, you didn't think twice. You just took it. And people knew that. It wasn't a sweatshop. And then, being able to put teams together And people, you know, people didn't always like the work that came in, but you'd put teams together where if someone got a great project once, then they'd do a little bit of time and give someone else a chance. And there was always constant learning. There was always constant responsibility. People felt empowered. And I think that's, you know, in terms of tactical things, John, there's gimmicky things like take your dog to work or ping pong or whatever. And that was big. That was kind of big back then. It's table stakes now-ish. Or maybe even not, but you know, it was more about the community, and the philosophy, than it was anything gimmicky. I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, for sure. You mentioned that, the company got as big as 30 to 50 employees, you know, the variants being contractors to, you know, based on the projects. Was there some trigger that made you decide to sell? I mean, looked like you sort of had a good run. What was the trigger?
Ultimately, I mean, there's a big story leading up to the sale, but ultimately what led me to sell was a great mutual respect between myself and the CEO of Spiria. To this day, we continue a very strong friendship. And also the alignment of each other's company goals, I suppose.
Tell me the story. You said there's a great story leading up. Tell me the story.
Oh, I didn't say great story. I said there's a story. well, you know, I get like you, like most people, you get 50 cold calls a day, I suppose. And it just so happens one day I picked up this cold call from a broker or a search broker that Spiria had employed. And he says, "Hey, Jordan, you know, I've got this company I'm working with. They're out of Quebec. Their thesis is they want to move from the Quebec landscape and into the rest of Canada, into the Toronto market. They believe doing business outside of Quebec, being a Quebec business, you need a presence outside. And they're looking to acquire and they're looking for someone exactly your size." And John, you know, like I would get 3, 4, 5 of these feelers every year. I was convinced at the time if you weren't getting that, you're doing something wrong. So I almost just ignored it. I said, you know what? I was just feeling generous that day. Fine. I'll give him my time. And, we met downtown Toronto. And we met for lunch and I showed up in, you know, a pair of jeans and a, you know, t-shirt or something. You know, I wasn't suited up or anything. And we meet and, you know, he says, you know, is this how you dress most of the time? I said, yeah, you know, this is me. And this is my business. My business follows that. And I saw a big smile on his face. And that was sort of the start of me warming very quickly, to Stefan. His name's Stefan, warming very quickly and realizing, the compatibility of our cultures, what it would give my employees, my team, their families, the opportunities that would be gained. And if you ask me, John, about a big aha moment of when I decided to sell, you know, learning, at first I said no. At first, they put in an offer and it was sort of a, hey, Jordan, walk away if you want to walk away and we'll give you basically kind of 1x revenue and you can just kind of wash your hands of it. And I explained to him, I said, Stefan, you know, that's not really aligned with where I want to go with this business. I was using the business to build a portfolio of other equity positions and all that. And I was meeting great people, had great clients. And I said, okay, Stefan, you know, I know what I want. I'm going to turn you down on this. You know, thanks for the offer. Let's keep in touch over the years. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're always second guessing yourself. You've got this gut feel like, did I make the wrong decision? Like it was a tough decision. Knowing what I wanted out of the business, knowing what I could have taken it, even if I did not grow it, it kind of led me to this conclusion that no was the right answer there. So I went out and
$4 million in revenue at this point.
I was between 1 and 3. I fluctuated between 1 and 3 in those final years.
Got it.
In revenue.
That's a big gap. So yes. Like why such a big gap? It's a huge gap between 1 and 3. What's the story there?
It's It's a big gap. I'm given a range for obvious reasons, but also
okay, you don't want to share. Okay, it's not that you 1 year you made 1 million, next year you made three. You're just saying, you know, generally it was in that sort of range.
It was generally in that sort of range. It wasn't that big of a fluctuation, but we did do a lot of business with startups, and carrying costs for startups led to some fluctuations and some write offs. So yeah.
Okay, helpful. So Stefan offered, and just, I want to go back, the meeting you had in downtown Toronto, you showed up in a t-shirt and jeans. It was Stefan who was meeting with you in Toronto. He was the one who posed the question, is this the way you normally dress? Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Got it. I thought it was the broker who asked that question of you to begin with, but now I understand it's Stefan. Okay. That's ripple.
Sorry.
Got it. And so he offers you 1x revenue. You're like, it's not really a great fit. Where does it go from there?
After that, in sort of good faith, I did a gut check. And in order to sort of validate my decision, I went out and solicited a couple more bids. So I would get a couple feelers, as I said, every year. And I was working with a few companies who, back then money was flowing, mandates were daunting. Deadlines were short. Sometimes it would, instead of hiring a team, usually I'd get inquiries, you know, instead of us hiring our own big team, let's just suck you guys in and you guys can be our tech team. So I went to them, and we started talking a little bit more. And I said, you know, Stefan, look, you told me I could take a walk. However, like, is that what you actually wanted? He's like, no, absolutely not. Like I would have loved for you to come on. I got the impression that you wanted to wash your hands. So I guess that kind of underlined the confidence that I had now that I had shopped around, but the confidence also to go back and realize that I had the opportunity to have a conversation with this person who was attempting to buy my baby, my identity, my livelihood. So you know, those conversations sort of continued, and we got to this point where, okay, if your goals are X, my goals are also X, and you can help me get to X by doing this, and I can help you to get to X to do this. Like, it was just kind of a match made in heaven. And then came down to the financials, where, you know, I really did a good job, I really tried to point the business in the direction I felt it was going. So we did 60% of our revenue was with startups back then. I didn't want that anymore. We were tired. They were engaging for the employee base, but it was tiring work. So they were more mid-market and enterprise. So with that fit, I thought, okay, well, that'll help my employees grow. That'll help us grow. And I think, you know, with their brand, you know, Dev Barbecue, John, you said it, like Dev Barbecue. If I'm going to do enterprise business, I probably would have had to rebrand something I had zero experience in. And I didn't even know how to start spending money on something like that. So I could take their brand. They could take my culture, my team, integrate it into ours. And then we'll go after the more mid-market enterprise and we'll all win. So essentially at the end, that was the aha. It's like all of these other fits and the shopping that I did, like that they weren't fits like Stefan and Spiria was. And we had become friends through this whole negotiation process. There was nothing competitive about this process. It was all collaborative. It was all finding how do you win and how do I win. I knew what I wanted the lifestyle was stuff we talked before, but I knew what I wanted out of the deal in terms of payout and earnout. I knew my minimum payout. I knew what I wanted there because if I don't have full control over the earnout, and anyone who's selling a services business and who has an earnout knows they don't have full control over that amount. So you need to be, or I wanted to be, I should say, I wanted to be comfortable with what I got as a payout and make sure that he and I both felt it was fair. So that's where I started kind of punching above my weight a little bit. And it was less so, I shouldn't say punching above my weight. That was pointing to the synergies between our two companies. that was pointing to all of the benefit from his perspective that Spiria would get from Dev Barbecue. It had very little to do with me, although I would talk personally with him as well. This is what I want for my family. And, you know, my goals were just, I suppose, like, I'm not just looking to buy 10 Teslas. I want to give my family a better life.
Are you able to share what your minimum number was in either dollar amount or as a multiple of EBITDA or multiple of revenue or some proxy to help our listeners kind of understand what was your minimum, knowing that you also wanted to participate in some of the potential upside of an earnout?
Yeah, my minimum, I ended up selling for 12x EBITDA. And my minimum payout was 7x EBITDA. So I wanted a pretty good chunk of that payout. We also negotiated a little bit. I took a little bit of a smaller payout, a little bit of a discount to get it all up front. That's a pretty normal thing, I believe, as well. So we were happy there. And then we started, the integration and the post sale, work to realize our goals.
So you were hoping to get 7x EBITDA as a upfront payment with, if you hit future goals and the stars align and everything worked out, that there would be the potential that it could ultimately be as much as 12 times. That was sort of the range that you were hoping for. 7 downstroke, 12. Correct. Got it.
Correct.
And you were able to get close to the 7 upfront, although a little bit of a haircut.
I took a bit of a haircut in order to de-risk the payout and have it all upfront. Yes.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And interestingly, when you went after the first offer from Stefan, and then you went and sort of shopped it a little bit and to see like what the market was, did you get any offers at that point? What were people saying it was worth when you kind of went to the other people?
Yeah, they were saying it was, think back actually. I didn't get any firm offers. I didn't pursue it beyond that. And by the time I got to that stage with them, I had already been discussing other options with Stefan. And I knew that the fit there wasn't great. So I kind of poured all my effort into Stefan. But I did know that, and I built comfort within the whole process. So it was less stressful for me throughout this whole process, that I knew I had other options if it came to that. So either way, if this deal with Spiria fell through, I'd be okay. I'd still have a great business. Or if I got married through this whole process to the idea of selling, I had these other options, and they were giving me, a little bit lower, than Spiria. It wasn't that much lower. That no, one was higher. Sorry, you'll have to sort through my thoughts here, but one was higher, one was lower, but it was around the same, John.
Got it. Okay. So that's interesting. And I'm also curious to know how you structured the earnout, because we've heard lots of stories on this show. We're up to episode 450 or something like that. And I think it's fair to say that earnouts have a mixed reputation on the show. Some people have done really well from earnouts, and I can recall examples of companies that have really become, it's not uncommon for a company to double in value once you fold in the value of an earnout. Equally, we've had as many or maybe more stories where it's been a disaster. Like, it's like oil and water. The entrepreneur lasts six weeks as an employee and they don't get anything. So it sounds like in your case, you were able to get to the 12. So I'd be curious to know what went into the structuring to make it work.
Well, the initial alignment of each of our goals and our cultures, that was huge. Being able to have the foresight and the buy-in from, I guess, both parties here, that the recognition from both parties that was a good fit, just brought confidence to the whole post-sale. I had a position of power, where I could make decisions. I could continue running my business, in many ways, the same as I always had. And we structured it in a sense where I was sort of just a branch of Spirit. I wasn't being rolled in, and I had new bosses or anything. I answered directly to Stefan. And he was really he was the only person I answered to, but I got peers. So in terms of a hierarchy, I was second. I was on tier two with the other kind of general managers of the other branches. And I knew working with Stefan, I'd learned over the process that, he had a very similar leadership style, to me. So getting to know each other through that process was important. The way we negotiated collaboratively and not competitively, that gave me confidence, in the earnout as well. And I think it was also important for me to know that even if the earnout had amounted to zero, I still feel like I got, the value that I built, out of the company.
What was your earnout tied to? Was it EBITDA of the Toronto office or revenue, or what was the trigger up for?
It was exactly that. It was EBITDA of the Toronto office. Yeah. And we would have to pay, we paid a corporate fee for some services, but we got some new infrastructure. So, based on that infrastructure and meeting a bunch of people at Spiria, again, that went into, here's what you're going to get from Spiria in this earnout structure, marketing, sales, brand, all this stuff that I really didn't have. And that helped me carry forward into an earnout. Oh, and John, can't believe I forgot this part. I did not have golden handcuffs. I had the earnout, but there was no requirement for me to stick around for it. If the office did what we thought it was going to do, I'd get it regardless. I ended up sticking around until the end and hitting the numbers. But that was a huge leap of faith from Stefan. And I made sure to reward that by seeing it through to the end.
That's really interesting. And it's a good reminder for our listeners that your role as an employee of the company that acquires you and the role of shareholder, potential earnout recipient, are and often are separate, right? So in this case, you mm-hmm. were an employee as well as the shareholder and potential participant in an earnout payment and which you achieved. But those things were actually separate and treated separately. So that's really interesting for sure for our folks. I'd be curious to know, you created this great culture. When I asked you, what was the one thing that allowed you to go from 7 employees to 30 to 50 employees? You were emphatic about it. You said, it's my culture. You didn't equivocate at all in the answer. It was very fast and very specific. And so I'd be curious to know how you handled telling these employees that you had sold to Spiria.
Yeah, I warmed them up a bit. Like I said before, transparency has always been a policy of mine, to the extent it affects my employees, for sure. They have a right to know some things that they come into work every day for. So we didn't lose a single person in the transition. I think it was managed very well, but it was managed jointly. So I had given them hints that, we've met this company, they're looking at a partnership. At first, it wasn't a lie. I mean, we were kind of looking how to work together. And then I started seeding with them slowly, like getting them warmed up to the point where, to points where Spiria's partnership is now turning into something deeper. I don't know what it looks like yet. And I didn't. But I was keeping them updated through it. I was respecting them as employees. And then when it did happen, I was set to go up to Montreal on a trip. I said, look, I'm going to meet everybody. I'm going to see like where the fit is. I came back and I made sure to tell them, like they do things very similar to us. This could be a really good fit, in terms of a partnership. They threw out acquisition. Here's what that means for you guys if this goes through. And that meant, more mid-market, less startups, more predictable revenue, growth opportunities, across like changing departments, changing job roles, training, learning French, like everything. I threw it all out there at them. But again, it was from their frame of mind. It wasn't from mine, which was important. That's what they care about, them and their families and their colleagues, what's going to happen. So I kept it about that. And then when the deal did happen, I said, I didn't celebrate it too much. I said, hey guys, I think there's a wonderful opportunity. We're going to be acquired by Spiria, and they're coming, you know, whatever, next week to meet you all. They're really excited to meet. And they were. It was all the truth. They came, they did a presentation on here's Spiria, here's, you know, here's where we come from, here's our roots, here's our beliefs, our philosophies. And it was, you know, we Stefan and I had planned that a little bit ahead of time. So what are they going to care about? So we were very deliberate in how we messaged everything, and not to cover anything up, but it was just to make sure that they heard what they needed to quell any concerns right off the bat. So there was no gossip. There was nothing going on in the background about anything. It was very clear and it was very transparent.
And what was their reaction?
They were thrilled. It was very well managed, and a few of them were a little bit nervous, and rightly so, but they, you know, open door policy, I guess you call it. They asked the right questions, you know, how it affects them, how it affects their learning and their development and the projects that they're working on. You know, but at the end of the day, just a calm collective validating their emotions. You know, my wife is now a psychotherapist, and she kind of taught me, you know, let's just validate their emotions. Listen, you don't always have to provide a solution. You know, so that's, you know, taking sort of that counseling, putting it into that application worked very well.
What was Kevin's reaction?
Yeah, it's a good question. Kevin was really happy for me. Like, we're very close friends. And you know, he saw the pain and the sacrifice that I went through, and the personal transformations, and the mental health that I had to deal with over those years since he exited the partnership. And he was really happy for me, and he was excited about the future of the company. And he's still there to, at the time of this recording, he's still working with Stefan at Spiria. And, he was great. He was great about it.
That takes a big person to do that, right? Because on some level, it was probably some level of resentment that, like, here I was as a shareholder, I sold early, and now here's Jordan making off like a bandit. But at the end of the day, equity is different than employment, and he had his option and he chose to sell. So I big of him for remaining magnanimous and, you know, congratulating you and feeling happy for you, which is, I think, is great.
Definitely. And yeah, maybe he had a little of those regrets, but I don't think he ever regretted his decision overall. Like I said, he saw the sacrifice that it took. And he kind of sidestepped that, for the benefit of, the company overall. No, I wish you didn't say that, but yeah, he got to sidestep that piece.
Did you lose any employees over the sale of the company? Did anybody quit?
Not a single person. No.
Amazing. Your winning streak. People are going to be asking you for culture development consulting because your winning streak on retaining employees is incredible. Are you up for a quick lightning round before hilarious. I let you go?
I'm up for anything, James.
I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions before I let you go. All right, cool. You talked to a couple of, it sounds like your relationship with Stefan was second to none and fantastic. You did talk to a few acquirers. Was there a slimy trick or an underhanded tactic that anyone used to try to pull the wool over your eyes?
No, I think I was, the timing of the market was such that I was in a position of power. So I think I knew what I wanted. I think people could tell that in terms of the confidence I exuded. My explanation of my options, for, you know, either continuing the business as is, I was happy as is, it was fine. I didn't need to sell. So that position, really gave me the strength, even mentally and emotionally to go in that way. And I worked very hard to set that up mentally for myself. as well, so I could bring that to the table.
You know, golfers talk about a mulligan, the idea that you could take one shot and scratch it from the scorecard and have a do-over. What's your mulligan? Like, if you could do the whole process of selling your company again from that first meeting in Toronto when you showed up in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt through to a successful earnout, what's the one thing you might do differently?
Nothing in the process, John. And that might sound not so interesting. However, I attached far too much of my identity to that business, and I would do that very differently. Losing that piece or that change, it took a lot out of me through those earnout years, and it was all about me and my headspace. That's what I would change. I would not assign as much of my identity to my business if I did it.
How would you do that?
Well, having partners would have helped for sure. Having a board of advisors would have helped. I had one advisor, but that was about it. Sharing more responsibility, that would have helped as well. And I think just, I was a software developer and I'm an introvert. So, you know, whenever people problems happened, I took it very heavily and I didn't really know how to solve them. So I would probably have delegated a little bit more, such that, you know, it wasn't always the owner doing wearing all the hats, but there was just more support in the areas that I needed it, instead of trying to absorb and get better at the things that I wasn't great at.
What about the emotional high? Was there a moment that you look back and think that was the pinnacle? Like, some people describe it as the, you know, I've heard stories where they're updating their phone and trying to like see their internet banking refresh. So to see the wire hit and they remember where they were when the wire hit, or maybe they're in the lawyer's office. Like, for you, is there a moment that feels like that was the top, that's what I felt the highest emotionally?
Yes. Yes, it was. We closed on December 31st and we were hosting a bit of a New Year's Eve party at our house. And I was on the call with the lawyers to confirm the close. And I don't know, it may have been 6:30 at night on December 31st. So, you know, I've got a glass of champagne in my hand. We're all on the call. The lawyers say, okay, we're closed. And I did exactly that, John. I had my bank account open. I was like, I had to confirm the transfer, right? And like I was on the call to confirm the transfer, and it arrived. And, it was a huge high. We partied, my wife and I and our friends, we partied hard that night. We had a great time and, woke up the next morning. And to be honest, John, the next morning, the high was gone a little bit. You know, now it's, you know, maybe it's my personality type, but okay. Like, now it's time to get to work on that earnout, right? So like, what's next? So, it was less of a lasting high than I would have thought, but it was great while it did last.
We talked about the business being, you know, frankly, and not to be crass, but a wealth generation tool for you. And it certainly sounds like it was. That, you know, I've got your list here of dream, like the lifestyle, the cottage, the travel, the kids' school. Did you buy yourself a trophy? Tell me you bought yourself something physical to commemorate the win.
I bought my cottage up north, John. That's what I bought. Tell me about it. It was early enough. Oh, it's not a mansion, but it's respects the outdoors. It's on a great, you know, kind of small, low boat traffic lake, with great neighbors, a great community, surrounded by wilderness. It's an underdeveloped area. So, you know, you don't see huge boathouses everywhere. That's what I loved. It's quiet. It's an escape. And my kids are young enough to now grow up with it. That's the experience I wanted to give them. I didn't have it as a kid, but we rented cottages and I loved it. So that, if I had a trophy, John, that was it. I also bought a convertible Audi, which was nice. But honestly, like, I would recommend against going out and buying a car, because it's just a car. That's sure. Just my personal take, though.
Yeah, no, but I love the vacation home, because, you know, for a lot of us, we have, you know, warm feelings about vacation properties. It's the time of our lives where we're excited and happy and in a good mood. And to have that attached to this incredible achievement, I think is a great way to celebrate the win. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Jordan, you're not sitting around at the cottage 365. You've got another business started. What's the name of the new company? And tell me, like, just 30 seconds on, let me the elevator pitch on what are you doing now?
Sure. Yeah. The new company is called Apex. I got into it, because of, you know, the culture we've been talking about, John, kind of trying to measure that a little bit and trying to align that with your customer experience, which was so important to me, in the Dead Barbecue days. So Apex offers, it's an additive intelligence platform for CEOs, CXOs, and insights teams. We combined behavioral science and AI, and essentially, we help businesses get the most from their customers and hit their goals.
Cool. And the website is?
Website is apexscore.ai.
apexscore.ai. And if people wanted to reach out to you on social, is LinkedIn the best place to do that? Or do you prefer Instagram? Or what's the social place that you would send people to if they want to say hi?
Yeah, I'm a bit of an anomaly. I'm a tech guy. I don't have Facebook or Instagram. LinkedIn is absolutely the best way. I believe I have a button on my LinkedIn profile for a quick meet and greet. And yeah, always open to networking and meeting new people.
And we'll put Apex and Jordan's LinkedIn profile in the show notes at builttosell.com. Jordan, thanks for doing this.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And there you have it for today's episode between John and Jordan. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then be sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And if you want to help support this podcast, I always encourage you to share this episode out with a friend or colleague. For show notes, including links to everything referenced in today's episode, including definitions for some of the more technical terms that you may or may not be as familiar with, you can visit Jordan's episode page over at builttosell.com. Special thanks to Dennis Labataglia for handling today's audio engineering, and thank you to our community of certified value builders who help us bring our message to you. Our advisors are experts in helping you build the value of your company. To get in touch with an advisor or learn how to become one yourself, be sure to visit valuebuilder.com. I'm Colin Morgan, and I'll talk to you again next week.